Mormons came over on Friday, as usual, and we looked at one of their nice videos on the temples. Mormons are big on temples and nice photography, and that was the highlight of our Friday hour and a half together, and we just commented a little bit about that. So I brought up the third temple that the Jews are planning to be in Jerusalem to kind of be one up on Mormon temples with them a little bit, and they're good kids. I actually have some friends, some college friends, that are inviting Mormon missionaries over and enjoying it. So that's just a little word of chastening to those of you who are not making friends with Mormons and leading them to Jesus, to the real Jesus. We are in the middle of Job. We're at chapter 8 today. Job is lived about in the time of the patriarchs, about 4,000 years ago. Very wealthy man. Very godly man, well known in the whole region of southern Jordan where he lived. A great family man, a great father, and suddenly out of the blue, a series of terrible catastrophes have come upon him, one right after the other. First of all, there were some terrible raids from some Iraqis and some Al-Qaeda terrorists who came in and plundered all of flocks, camels and sheep, and rendered him broke. And then something awful happened to his seven sons and three daughters. They were all killed in a tragic fire or tornado or something that killed them all in one day. And then, on top of that, his health went bad, and he is broken out with boils and sores and suffering absolutely miserably. His whole life has just completely fallen apart. His wife, of course, is going through a lot of misery, but she's not a lot of help. Can't blame her for not being totally supportive. And Job's super neat best friends from church, well, they didn't have church then, come over at long distance. They all got emails, and they were watching CNN. They saw this happen, and they come and show up to comfort him, and they're so overwhelmed with shock that they sit 7 days before saying anything. They come to comfort him. Unfortunately, what his three friends have to say to him is the worst of all the things that's happened to Job, as we'll see. It just adds insult to injury, and we're right in the middle of these speeches that his three friends make in series of three and Job's answers to them. What we know something that Job doesn't know, and we know that this has all happened because God and Satan were having a little conversation one day, and God brought up the subject of what a good guy Job was, and Job said, your man Job, and the devil said, Job's a phony, he's faking it, and his motives are wrong, and if you were to put some trials in his life, he'd curse you. And God said, okay. As if there was a little game going on between God and the devil, and that Job's a kind of pawn in all this, you know, and that God can be easily talked into bringing this horrible misery on one of his choice servants. At this point, it sounds like this is scary. Maybe this had happened to any of us. We don't know the whole thing yet. We don't know what God intends to do with this tragic situation, and this end of the story is very, very happy. But in the meantime, we've got to suffer through this day by day. Job is, of course, searching for answers also, as we usually do in a time of suffering or disaster. Why did somebody die that was when they were young? Why did so-and-so get cancer and suffer so terribly? Why do people... things that we hadn't expected come crashing in on us sometimes in waves. Last week we had the speech of the first of Job's friends, Eliphaz, whom Ray Sedman calls Eliphaz the Eloquent because he starts out being fairly polite and he makes a nice speech. And the bottom line of his speech, the conclusion of all that he has to say is, well, Job, it's pretty obvious that you've sinned. This wouldn't happen to you in a universe with a good God unless you had sinned And so the fix to this is that you got to find, identify the sin and repent, and then God will fix it all. Wrong? Wrong? He suggests that maybe God's chastening him. Wrong? Job's pretty smart. He recognizes that this speech by his friend is not hitting the mark. It's not speaking to his real situation, and he says so. And as a matter of fact, Job is furious at the remarks of his super neat friend Eliphaz. And Job is still he's longing to die. He is miserable. He's beginning to wonder why all this is happening. And so far he's not happy with the advice of friend number one. Now friend number two, chapter 8. Bildad. Bildad the Brutal is what this Ray calls this guy. A little short speech here. Bildad the Shuhite. Remember, this is the shortest man in the Bible, whose only shoe height. That's a John Aniker special. That's the next shortest guy is Nehemiah, as you know. How long will you speak these? Bildad says, how long will you speak these things and the words of your mouth be like a strong wind? You windbag, Job. I've been listening to you doing all this complaining and all this crying out in despair, but that's just a bunch of wind. That's not something nice to say to somebody who's hurting really, really terribly and who's simply expressing their emotions. That's not very kind, is it? Does God subvert judgment, or does the Almighty pervert justice? That's El Shaddai there. How can God act unjustly? If the bad things are happening to you, that's just an expression of God's justice, isn't it? Well, sometimes, but not always. Now, here's a really nasty one. If your sons have sinned against you, he has cast them away for their transgression. He's sort of suggesting that Job's seven sons have all been killed because there was sin in their lives and they hadn't dealt with it, so God's wiped them out. Summarily, that's a terrible thing to say to a grieving father, probably with a grieving mother over listening to this whole conversation. And it's not likely to be true either, because we know that these were godly sons, and on their birthday every year, Job would go and offer a sacrifice for each one of them just to make sure, to cover any sins that they might have accidentally committed during the year. So we have no reason whatsoever to think that this terrible disaster could have anything to do with seven sons and their sins. And what about the three daughters? But that's his innuendo here. If you would earnestly seek God and make your supplication to the Almighty, if you were pure and upright, implication you're not, see that there? Job, you ought to go pray. If you just take this to God, and if you really had a pure heart, surely now God would awake for you. Well, that's a very simple matter to diagnose. There's something wrong in your life, and if you'd clean up your act a little bit and go to God, he'll come through right away. He always does. Nope. Surely now he would awake for you and prosper your rightful habitation, though your beginning was small. You started out, remember back when you started out farming and ranching and you were first married and you didn't have anything, and how God brought you up to fame and fortune and a great family? Your latter end would increase abundantly. So if you'd get right with God, God will restore everything, and you'll be better off in the long run than you would have been in the first place. That's not very kind. How do you make up for seven sons and three daughters that you love dearly, and they're gone? And who's going to bring them back? Who's going to give you back your estate as it was? You don't say that to somebody who's suffered this irrecoverable loss, do you? For inquire, please, of the former age. Now, Eliphaz has had a dream, and he's drawn on his own experience, and he's giving Job advice based on how he's experienced life, and Bildad wants to be one up on that, so he doesn't appeal to his own experience. He appeals to the wisdom of the fathers. He's going to look, he says, let's look at the wise men who have lived and gone before us. Inquire, please, of the former age, consider the things discovered by our fathers. Let's go back and read some of the great treasured literature and see what others in the past have done in situations like this. We are all but yesterday, and we know nothing. Our days on earth are a shadow, so we don't really know very much. Will they, the fathers, not teach you and tell you and utter words from their hearts? So we need some wisdom literature, and we can go read books on people who've suffered before and learn all about God that way. Okay, now he's got this little speech in here about how fragile nature is. Can the papyrus grow up without a marsh? No, papyrus is very water sensitive. Can the reeds flourish without water? No. While it is yet green and not cut down, it withers before any other plant. So are the paths of all who forget God. There you see, Job, you've forgotten God, so you're shriveling up like a papyrus without water. I've got it all figured out for you, Job. And the hope of the hypocrite will perish. That's not too subtle, is it? Job, you're a hypocrite. That's not nice to say to somebody. Even if it were true, you wouldn't say that to a guy in this much misery and suffering, would you? So, yeah. We're going to find some self-righteousness in Job and in his friends before we're through. The hypocrite will perish, whose confidence shall be cut off, and whose trust is a spider's web. He leans on his house, but it does not stand. He holds it fast, but it does not endure. He grows green in the sun, and his branches spread out in his garden. His roots wrap around the rock heap and look for a place in the stones. If he is destroyed from his place, then it will deny him, saying, I've not seen you. Hypocrites build these kind of phony lives that have no substance, and that's probably the reality of Job of where you're at. Behold, this is the joy of God's way, and out of the earth others will grow. God will not cast away the blameless. Oops, that's another little bit of innuendo. There's blame in you, otherwise God wouldn't have cast you out, because God never rejects blameless people, does he? Yes, he does. Can you think of a blameless person that got rejected by God? Jesus did, yeah. So there's some things in here that are less than accurate in the light of the real God. He will yet fill your mouth with laughing and your lips with rejoicing. Those who hate you will be clothed with shame, and the dwelling place of the wicked will come to nothing. Okay, Job, you've got to repent, clean up your act, get right with God. God will fix everything. He'll give you a rich, wonderful life again. Wrong. That's not why Job is suffering. So far, we don't know why Job is suffering, except for that little behind the scenes at the beginning about God and Satan. All right. Job's reply. Job is learning and searching, and we start getting some real neat questions coming up in here that are perennial questions. Job answered and said, truly I know it is so. How can a man be righteous before God? Is that a perennial question? Oh, yes. How can any of us sinners be righteous in the eyes of God? Why, that's what the whole book of Romans is all about, isn't it? How can a sinner be righteous before God? How can mortal creatures of dust who are full of sin, how can we possibly stand before God? So Job's asking that question. And this is kind of forensic. He kind of imagines a courtroom scene in which he'd like to bring a legal case with a good lawyer here, and he'd like to have somebody go up and present his case before God and have God answer in court where he had some clout. You know, how do you go argue with the Almighty? Truly I know it is so. How can a man be righteous before God? If one wished to contend with him, he could not answer him one time out of 1,000. God is wise in heart and mighty in strength. Who has hardened himself against him and prospered? Who could defy God? He removes the mountains and they do not know when he overturns them in his anger. He shakes the earth out of its place. Its pillars tremble. He commands the sun and it does not rise. He seals off the stars. He alone spreads out the heavens. And he treads on the waves of the sea. He made the Bear, the Orion, and the Pleiades. Those are constellations of the sky that we still have today. Those far distant stars don't move very much over the centuries. They're still the same constellations we know. And the chambers of the south. Nobody knows what the chambers of the south is, some astronomical object. God does great things past finding out. Yes, he does. Wonders without number. True. If he goes by me, I do not see him. If he moves past, I do not perceive him. God's invisible. How in the world do you deal with an invisible God who can sneak in and out and you'll never even be, you can't pin him down? He's invisible. How helpless I am in bringing my case because I can't sit and look him in the eye. And I haven't got a lawyer yet. If he takes away, who can hinder him? Who can stop God from taking things away? Who can say to him, what are you doing? Job's perfectly ready to admit that his situation is from God, that God's caused this calamity. He just doesn't know why. God will not withdraw his anger. The allies of the proud lie prostrate under him. We know from history that God judges evil ruthlessly, and that the great evil men in the past have been judged in evil nations, and nobody can stop God when he moves in judgment. How then can I answer him and choose my words to reason with him? I need a really good lawyer. For though I were righteous, I could not answer him. And I'm not really righteous. I've got flaws and sin in me, so I can't meet God on his moral level, on his moral plane. I would beg mercy of my judge. If I could appear in court before him, I would cry out for mercy. I wouldn't pretend to stand on my own integrity. If I called and he answered me, I would not believe that he was listening to my voice. How do I know that it's God speaking to me from the courtroom with all the calamity of other things speaking? How would I recognize it was really God? He crushes me with a tempest. He multiplies my wounds without cause. I don't understand why all these ugly, awful boils have happened to me and all this loss has happened to me. It's got to be an answer. He will not allow me to catch my breath. He fills me with bitterness. If it is a matter of strength, indeed he is strong, and if of justice, who will appoint my day in court? If God's got a case against me, let's have a courtroom trial so that he can lay out the charges specifically and I can answer them. And my attorney can put up my defense, or I can plead guilty or whatever, but I don't know what the charges are against me. This is really right out of the heart, isn't it? Out of the heart of his suffering and anguish. Though I were righteous, my own mouth would condemn me. Though I were blameless, it would prove me perverse. Stand up and make a great big speech before God, and you'd probably fall flat on your face, wouldn't you? You probably had that, probably had a whole bunch of arguments sometimes in your life when you want to bring your case before God and you think it through and you realize that your case is full of holes. Never stand up in court. So this is poor Job. I am, verse 21, I am blameless, yet I do not know myself. I despise my life. There's three clues in this chapter that are important clues. The first one was in verse 2. How can a man be righteous before God? That's a long-term red alert signal. The second one is in verse 21. I am blameless, yet I do not know myself. I see myself as blameless, because I've dealt with all the sin that I'm aware of in my life. God has said that he's blameless. Probably he's got plenty of affirmation that he's a righteous man. But he's not saying I'm totally blameless. He says there may be things in my life that I'm not aware of. I am blameless. I don't know myself. I despise my life. It is all one thing. Therefore, I say he destroys the blameless and the wicked. As far as I know, I haven't done anything wrong, and here God is destroying me. If the scourge slays suddenly, he laughs at the plight of the innocent, as if God really did. It's just kind of a little sarcasm here. The earth is given into the hand of the wicked. He covers the faces of its judges. If it is not he, who else could it be? If bad things are happening in the world, who's in charge? If terrible calamities are happening, who's in the position of stopping them? Therefore, God is sovereign, and he allows all these things to go on, and he could stop them, but he doesn't. So there's an acknowledgement. All these guys acknowledge God's sovereignty over everything, and they also acknowledge that God is just. So that's, all of them have got that part correct. Verse 25. Now my days are swifter than a runner. They flee away, they see no good, they pass by like swift ships, like an eagle swooping on its prey. If I say, I will forget my complaint, I will put off my sad face and wear a smile, I am afraid of all my sufferings. I know that you will not hold me innocent. My whole life is slipping away from me. What a short life it was. And it was a wasted life in view of where I am right now. All those happy years I had with my wife and my family and my friends, it's all gone, and life is over too quickly, and woe is me. See that in there? And I rather suspect when I stand before you, I'm not as innocent as I think I am. But I don't know why. If I'm condemned, why then do I labor in vain? Why am I struggling? If I'm guilty, why don't you just send me to punishment? If I wash myself with snow water and cleanse my hands with soap, yet you will plunge me into the pit, and my own clothes will abhor me. What's that about? How in the world, if I happen to be sinful, how in the world can I cleanse myself? Perennial question. I've done wrong. How do I get clean? How do I get a fix on the evil in my heart? Soap and water won't do it. He gets the fresh melted snow water, and he gets the best soap, and he scrubs and take a shower and take a bath. Does that wash away sin? No. What more do I do to get away sin, get sin out of my life if it's there? Clue number three. God is not a man as I am that I should answer him, and that we should go to court together. Nor is there any mediator between us who may lay his hand on us both. Let him take his rod away from me, and do not let dread of him terrify me. Then I would speak and not fear him, but it is not so with me. Aha! What is missing in Job's life so far that's now crystal clear to us? He does not know that there is, in fact, a mediator between God and man. He does not know that there is an attorney who will take up his case. He does not know that God is capable of feeling what it is to be a man, because God became a man, or will become a man.
It's interesting. I think Paul Stevens of Regent College called it the gospel according to Job.
Yes. We're getting right at the heart of here. What is wrong in Job's life is that he does not see God as an intimate, personal being with whom one can have a man-to-man relationship. Isn't that so important? Isn't that just essential to what we believe? What would we do if we had to go to a remote, impersonal God and who didn't understand human beings because he'd never been a man, never been in our shoes, never walked in our footsteps? Is there a mediator? Do we have somebody you can go to? Can you go to another man and have that other man take your case to God? Yes, you can. Go to Jesus, and he will represent your case to God. We know that now. Job will know it a little later. All right, there are some things in Job's life that need fixing. Perhaps that gives us a clue as to why God has allowed such a horrible set of catastrophes to come upon Job. Maybe he wouldn't have learned them short of any of these terrible trials. Maybe God couldn't have got this across to him without putting him through such a horrendous set of things. Could he be that stubborn inside, that hard? Yes, he could. Is the suffering of Job for nothing? No. No, it's not for nothing. God has some purpose he wants to bring, and obviously he wants to draw Job closer to himself. And before we're done, we're going to find out that Job discovers there is a mediator. He does have a defense attorney. He does have somebody he can go to who understands the human situation and our frailty and who will take his case to the Father. Isn't that awesome? To stop and think that what we take for granted, Job is going through this difficult time of discovery. So that's the clue. Job's friends don't have the right theology, but Job doesn't either. Chapter 10, my soul loves my life. Loathes my life. I will give free course to my complaint. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul. I will say to God, do not condemn me. Show me why you contend with me. Oh God, would you please explain yourself to me? I think many times we have that today in our lives where we do not understand what's going on. We cry out to God for insights, and he may not show us at the time why. The inscrutable nature of God. Does it seem good to you, God, that you should oppress, that you should despise the work of your hands? Does this seem good, Lord, that you should create me and give me this great life and then torture me like this? I mean, that just, from my point of view, doesn't seem right. Doesn't seem fair. Should you shine on the counsel of the wicked? Do you have eyes of flesh? Do you have eyes of flesh? Can you see things the way I see things? Answer, yes. Jesus sees things the way we see things. Do you see as a man sees? Yes. We say yes, he does. Are your days like the days of a mortal man? The days of Jesus were as the days of a mortal man. He only lived to be 30 or so. Are your years like the days of a mighty man that you should seek for my iniquity and search out my sin? Although you know that I'm not wicked, and there is no one who can deliver you from my hand, you yourself have pronounced me righteous. But see there, the longing for an intimate relationship with God, who understands, who's compassionate, who's caring, who meets us. How many people today have an idea of God as remote and impersonal and not as a friend? I think probably a lot of people do, actually, not realize that God, we meet God in Jesus, we meet him man to man, person to person, face to face, and Jesus identifies with our sin and our suffering, and he can take our case before the Father, and he can wash away all sin, and he understands our situation, and he's been through temptations. Pretty neat here. Verse 8, your hands have made me and fashioned me, an intricate unity, yet you would destroy me. What a marvelous construction is a human being. What an incredibly complicated work of art, a masterpiece of construction. And God builds these masterpieces and then he destroys them. As if we were just little clay statues and he could get rid of them like we were little toys. Remember, I pray, that you have made me like clay and you will turn me into the dust again. Hey, Lord, I'm pretty fragile. I'm pretty much at your mercy, and my end is going to be dust. Would you please take that into account in your dealings with me? I break easy. I'm very fragile. I'm vulnerable. Did you not pour me out like milk and curdle me like cheese? That's what he feels like in his sufferings. He's just been treated arbitrarily here. Clothe me with skin and flesh and knit me together with bones and sinews. You've granted me life and favor. Your care has preserved my spirit. I know you took good care of me for long years. That was obvious. You gave me good health and great family. These things you've hidden in your heart. I know that this was with you. If I sin, you mark me. You'll keep track of sin if I sin. You will not acquit me of my iniquity. If I'm wicked, woe to me. If I'm wicked, I deserve my punishment. Even if I'm righteous, I cannot lift up my head. I'm full of disgrace. He's shamed and humiliated in front of his friends and family and himself. If my head is exalted, you hunt me like a fierce lion. And again, you show yourself awesome against me. You renew your witnesses against me and increase your indignation toward me. Changes in war are ever with me. It's as if God's pursuing him like a wild animal and he feels like he's being hunted down. That's kind of what people feel when their situation you can't explain. Believe the worst from God. Why then have you brought me out of the womb? Oh, that I had perished and no eye had seen me. Said that before. Wish I'd never been born. I wish the day of my birth had been erased from the calendar. I wish I was still born. I wish I had never come into existence at all. Here's that same thing again. Oh, that I had perished and no eye had seen me. I would have been as though I had not been. I would have been carried from the womb to the grave. If I was still born, they'd have buried me right away, and that would have been a better way out. Are my not my days few? Cease. Leave me alone, that I may take a little comfort. God, you're watching. Your eye's on me. I'd like to just have a little time to myself. Can't ever get out of the presence of God. You know what David says, even if I make my bed in hell, behold, you are there, kind of thing. He'd like to just have some time of quiet to just think by himself. Before I go to the place from which I shall not return, Sheol, the grave, to the land of darkness and the shadow of death, a land as dark and as darkness itself, as the shadow of death without any order, where even the light is like darkness. So he longs for death, and Sheol in that day is simply the grave. It's simply that there's no thought here of heaven or hell or an afterlife, although that will come up a little bit shortly. Chapter 11. Zophar the Zealous. This is nasty, scorching, pure logic, not much compassion. Zophar the Naamathite answered and said, should not the multitude of words be answered, and should a man full of talk be vindicated? Should your empty talk make men hold their peace, and when you mock, should no one rebuke you? That's worse than calling Job a windbag. He's saying, I'm exasperated listening to all your empty words here. You'd be better if you just shut up. And this is empty talking. Somebody needs to rebuke you for shame on you talking this way. Don't you have a right to pour out your heart when you're hurting? Can't you tell your friends what's going on in your life? Well, of course you can. This is not a good friend at all. One thing in the book of Job is you kind of got to pretend what the tonal inflection of the speakers is. We're not there to hear the tone or the emphasis they're putting on. I'm kind of dramatizing it for you here a little bit, bringing out the worst in these guys, because I know the end of the story here, and maybe you don't yet. But. So it's polite speech, but it's got barbs buried in it. You have said my doctrine is pure and I'm clean in your eyes. You claim to be righteous? Open rebuke. But oh, that God would speak and open his lips against you, that he would show you the secrets of wisdom. They would double your prudence. If you knew the real God, if you know what I know about God, you'd never talk the way you do. I wish God would speak up right now, and that would really put you in your place, Job. Know therefore that God exacts from you less than your iniquity deserves. Whatever your sin is, it deserves even more punishment than you've already been experiencing. That's pretty hard to imagine. Does God deal with us according to our iniquities and after our sins? No. We know that God overlooks it, a lot of our faults and failures, and covers them with his grace. Can you search out the deep things of God? Can you find out the limits of the Almighty? Well, of course, Job can't, but neither can Zophar. They are higher than heaven. What can you do? Deeper than Sheol. What can you know? Their measure is longer than the breadth and broader than the sea. If he passes by, imprisons and gathers to judgment, who can hinder him? He knows deceitful men. He sees wickedness also. Will he not consider it? For an empty-headed man will be wise when a donkey's colt is born to a man. Now that's an open insult. On the day that an empty-headed man becomes wise, it'll be on that same day that a human being will be born to a wild donkey. And the implication here is Job, you're empty-headed and you're a stubborn mule. That's kind of the veiled idea here. If you would prepare, now we get a sermon. because he's got it all figured out. He's a sermon. If you would prepare your heart and stretch out your hands toward him, if iniquity were in your hand and you put it far away and would not let wickedness dwell in your tents, presumably, Job, you've done all these things, then surely you could lift up your face without spot. Yes, you could be steadfast and not fear, because you would forget your misery and remember it as waters that have passed away. Your life would be brighter than noonday, though you were dark. You would be like morning. You would be secure because there is hope. Yes, you would dig about you and take your rest in safety. You would lie down and no one would make you afraid. Yes, many would court your favor. The eyes of the wicked will fail, and they will not escape, and their hope, loss of life. If you'd clean up your act and confess your sins, God will fix everything. He'll put you right back together again. And therefore, all this calamity that's come upon you is because you've sinned. And you just won't admit it. And so I'm telling you. How's that? Job? Yeah. They're working on their speeches, and not only that, but they're each of them going to speak three times, and so they're refining their speeches, and the speeches get worse. So this is Job's greatest trial. Job's learning. Job's getting a little bit testy here. He's getting a little bit aggravated and putting up with all this nonsense here, he says. Job answered and said, "No doubt you are the people, and wisdom will die with you. You guys know it all. You're the wise men. When you die, there'll be no more wisdom left in the world. I have understanding as well as you do. I know my theology. I've been around a while. I know God. I'm not inferior to you. Indeed, who does not know such things as these? Look, what you've told me already is common knowledge among those of us who are God's people. You haven't said one thing that I didn't already know. I am one mocked by his friends who called on God and he answered him, the just and blameless who is laughed to scorn. A lamp is despised in the thought of one who is at ease. It is made ready for those whose feet slip. The tents of robbers prosper, and those who provoke God are secure in what God provides by his hand." The righteous do not always prosper. The righteous sometimes do suffer. So that's one of their arguments, is that this is all caused by sin, and Job defends himself and says, "No, there's no known sin in my life or I would admit it." So you haven't hit the nail on the head yet. "Now ask the beasts, and they will teach you, and the birds of the air, and they will tell you, or speak to the earth, and I will teach you, and the fish of the sea will explain to you. Who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this?" It's very obvious that my suffering and tragedy is from God, in whose hand is the life of every living thing and the breath of all mankind. "Does not the ear test words and the mouth taste its food? Wisdom is with aged men, and the length of days understanding." Job's got some great insights into God. He really has a very lofty view of God. "With God are wisdom and strength. He has counsel and understanding. If he breaks down a thing, it cannot be rebuilt. If he imprisons a man, there can be no release. If he withholds the waters, they dry up. If he sends them out, they overwhelm the earth. With him are strength and prudence. The deceived and the deceiver are his. He leads counselors away plundered. He makes fools of the judges. He loosens the bonds of kings, binds their waist with a belt. He leads princes away plundered. Overthrows the mighty. He deprives the trusted ones of speech and takes away the discernment of the elders. He pours contempt on princes," Psalm 107, "disarms the mighty. He uncovers deep things out of darkness, brings the shadow of death to light. He makes nations great and destroys them. He enlarges nations and guides them. He takes away the understanding of the chiefs of the people of the earth. Makes them wander in a pathless wilderness. They grope in the dark without light, and he makes them stagger like a drunken man." Disasters come. The sovereignty of God and all that, just got a good high view of God behind a very, very sound theology there. Now, Job says, "Behold, my eye has seen all this. My ear has heard and understood it. What you know, I also know. I'm not inferior to you. But I would speak to the Almighty." I want an answer from God, and you guys aren't speaking for God so far. "I desire to reason with God, but you are forgers of lies. You're worthless physicians. Oh, that you would shut up. Oh, that you would be silent. That would be your wisdom. You guys would just keep your mouths shut. That would be the best thing you could possibly do." That's good advice for us sometimes when somebody is hurting, to sit down and listen, and listen very, very carefully and shut up. And don't say something until you're absolutely sure that what you're saying is going to be helpful. Shut up. "Hear my reasoning and hear the pleadings of my lips. Haven't you been listening to the anguish of my heart? You came to comfort me. When you speak wickedly for God and talk deceitfully for Him, you claim to be representing God, and you're not on target. You're not telling me what I already know is true about myself. Will you show partiality with God? Will you contend for God? Are you going to stand up and present God's point of view and be found out to be a liar? Will it be well when He searches you out? What about when God calls you guys into court? Can you mock Him as one mocks a man? He will surely reprove you if you secretly show partiality. Will not His excellence make you afraid and the dread of Him fall upon you? Your platitudes are proverbs of ashes. Your defenses are defenses of clay." Job really slams them, and they deserve it. "Hold your peace with me and let me speak. Then come on me what may. Why do I take my flesh in my teeth and put my life in my hands? Though He slays me, yet I will trust Him." I'm going to trust God no matter what. I'm going to trust God even if He kills me. I'm not abandoning my faith. And I believe I'm standing in right with God until He shows me otherwise. "Even so, I'll defend my own ways before Him, and He also shall be my salvation." See the confidence he has way down deep inside. He's confident, and he hasn't lost his confidence in God. Absolutely right. There's a lot of great stuff in here. A hypocrite could not come before Him. "Listen diligently to my speech and to my declaration with your ears. See now, I prepared my case. I know that I shall be vindicated." This story is going to have a happy ending. I have confidence in God that He's going to make it right eventually. "Who is he who will contend with me? If now I hold my tongue, I perish. Only two things do not do to me, O God. Then I will not hide myself from you. Withdraw your hand far away from me, and let not the dread of you make me afraid." Lord, I want you to hear me. I want you to give me a compassionate hearing. I don't want to live in fear of you. "Call, and I will answer. Let me speak. Let me speak and respond to you. How many are my iniquities and my sins? Make me know my transgression and my sin. Why do you hide your face and regard me as your enemy?" Can you explain it? Well, of course, God hid His face from Jesus on the cross. "Will you frighten a leaf driven to and fro? And will you pursue dry stubble? You write bitter things against me and make me inherit the iniquities of my youth. You put my feet in the stocks and watch closely all my paths. You set a limit for the soles of my feet." Okay, pretty. Let me read you a little from Ray Steadman so that you all go by a set of his notes in back there. At the end of the book, God appears and says that Job has been saying the right things and that the friends are wrong in what they say. But at this point, we have to ask, what is wrong with this? The answer, of course, is that it is said in the wrong spirit. And what they leave out, what these men leave out, is wrong. There are three things wrong with their approaches. First, they answer Job's words without trying to find out what lies behind them. They zero in on what he says without understanding his agony. Who've gone through deep, unrelenting pain knows how this can test the spirit to the utmost, and we become testy and sharp. Because Job says certain things that sound extreme, his friends leap upon his words and try to analyze them without identifying with his hurt. There's a common problem in marriage. Husbands often are coldly analytical when their wives are pressured or weary or frightened about something. Husbands hear only the words and try to analyze them, and nothing can destroy a woman faster. The problem is that there's no identification with the hurt. The second thing is that these friends' theology is incomplete. They always speak with the utmost confidence that what they are saying is the final word on the subject. There is no apparent understanding that perhaps there were aspects of God and dimensions of the Word which they have not yet seen. As many of us do today, they judge only on the basis of a rigid theology that takes note of certain aspects of truth but ignores others. The third thing wrong with these friends is that they never pray with Job. They never ask God for help to open their minds, to illuminate their understanding so that they can help their friend. The book is filled with prayers, but they're all the prayers of Job, crying out to God in the midst of his sufferings. His friends never seem to feel the need for further illumination on the subject. Yet you cannot find much wrong with their arguments. What a testimony to us of the need to speak cautiously when we deal with the deep hurts and problems of life. Okay, the book is relevant for us, is it not? Steve?